Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, into your town, into your home, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of dark energy. You've arrived at a nexus point, a crossroads of shadow and light, a phantasmagorical marketplace of ideas and blasphemies from the benign to the bizarre, where we're all on the same path, searching for breadcrumbs of cosmic understanding and hoping we'll be able to follow the trail back to where we started. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, your designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophony of conversation. Glad to be back with you once again. I've been trying to put this show together for quite a while. Back when I first came on as a sometimes guest host for the program, 2.5 years ago or so, one of the very first shows I put together focused on the Area 51 mystery. And the reasons are obvious. One, it's something I knew pretty well and have been involved with from the beginning. Two, it's a topic that continues to be of considerable interest to a wide swath of people around the world. And three, because I have a longstanding relationship with the central players, the people most responsible for putting Area 51 on the map, turning it into a household term known all over the planet. Those people being Bob Lazar, Gene Huff, and John Lear. And it was a remarkable show back then, a lot of fun, gave us a chance to catch up, answer some of your questions. I tried to put that same group together back in May of this year, for what was the 20th anniversary of when Lazar first appeared on television, told his story, though he did it in silhouette under the pseudonym Dennis. And that was sort of what kickstarted my own investigation into the veracity of his tale and what was going on out there at Groom Lake. Lazar could not be with us for that show in May, but John Lear and Gene Huff told the story from their perspective, having lived through most of the central events from that time. Tonight, another anniversary. 20 years ago this coming week, we aired a TV program here in Las Vegas called UFOs, The Best Evidence. It was a two-hour primetime program, a compilation from a multi-part news series that we ran in our newscasts on KLAS, but with additional material edited differently. And it was a smash hit. Still the highest rated local TV special ever aired here. Bootlegs of that show have gone all over the place. It was never formally released, because we didn't really own all of the material that was in there. We could use it on TV, but not sell it. But those bootlegs still surface from time to time, and people discover the story all over again. And the reports inspired books and movies and countless articles and TV reports. And in essence, the world beat a path to the door of Area 51. And in that show, 20 years ago this week, we showed Bob Lazar's face for the first time, used his real name for the first time, had him tell his story directly into the camera to the world. And, you know, without exaggerating, it changed his life forever. It changed my life forever. Also those of Gene Huff and John Lear. And it changed the base itself. It's never quite been the same. It took a little bit of arm twisting and some begging, cajoling, but we put that crew back together again. And we'll spend tonight updating and reliving the Area 51 story. And I think if you have any interest whatsoever in the subject, you should enjoy the hell out of tonight's program. Gene Huff and John Lear will join me in hour two, and we'll stay for the rest of the evening. Bob Lazar will be chiming in just a couple of minutes from now, because I wanted to spend some time talking with him about non-UFO stuff. And specifically what I wanted to get into was his efforts to mass market a hydrogen fuel system, which he designed, a system that would replace gasoline as our primary fuel source for transportation, with implications that I don't need to explain right now. We'll find out how his system works, why it's not available now, and whether Lazar has been sort of thwarted on purpose in trying to bring this thing to market. It has, in my opinion, every bit as much intrigue and all the dark overtones of the UFO tale. So coming up in this half hour, a couple of minutes from now, Bob Lazar will be here, and I think we're going to have some fun with it. A couple of items to chat about before we bring him on. I'm out doing some grocery shopping this week, buying some extra stuff to store away in the pantry in case, you know, whatever happens. Canned goods that should last a while. And I noticed as I'm unpacking these cans, putting them away in the pantry, cans of pinto beans, the expiration date on top of the can, December 2012. December 2012, for crying out loud. Now what? Did the makers of these beans know something that we don't? Why did they choose that particular date? Are they channeling the ancient Mayans? Do they have their own bean maker calendar that shows the world's going to end at about the time those pintos go bad? And if you're wondering if I'm being sarcastic, the answer is yes. Just being a smarty pants. And it might not be funny, but the timing is impeccable because about 2 hours ago, I saw the box office numbers for this weekend. The film, 2012, is a huge hit. According to these figures I just read, it took in $225 million in its first weekend. That's worldwide. I think it's $65 million domestic gross, and that is big. So while I might poke fun at the idea that the world's about to end, it makes for some mighty fine popcorn entertainment, I'd say. It cost something like $200 million to make this movie. Not sure what they spent marketing it, but they certainly have the production costs back already. So this thing's going to be a smash. And I think it's the same team that produced another smash, Independence Day. Remember that movie? Aliens invade. And it ends with the folks at Area 51 leading the way to save the world. An interesting coincidence given our guests tonight. Also on the movie front, the last time I was here last month, we had Jim Channon on the show to talk about the real story behind the movie The Men Who Stare at Goats. I have not seen any box office numbers for that one. I got to guess that it's probably not doing too well considering all the other films that were released at the same time like last week or 2 weeks ago. But I did get to see a preview screening of it. And got to tell you, I thoroughly enjoyed it. I know I've seen some critics have gone both ways. Some critics don't like it, but I think you could do a lot worse than watching that movie. For instance, you could go see the new alien abduction film, The Fourth Kind. I haven't seen it, but those who have say it's not doing this subject any favor. This supposed archival footage of abduction experiences gone bad. The use of the term archival, it's kind of loose, I think. Not sure why the producers decided to pass it off as such. The movie, for example, was savaged by pioneer abduction researcher Bud Hopkins for obvious reasons. We have posted his review on the Coast to Coast website for you to read. If you're interested in reading some factual material about abduction research and where it all started, there is a sort of a special site on a place called AboveTopSecret.com. Those guys have been on the show before, something that they asked me to write for them. So check it out if you are so inclined. Also posted on the Coast website an assortment of other Naps news items of interest that I've been saving and which webmaster Tim Binal has added to as well. A couple of stories about developments in space exploration. Can we build a space elevator, for instance? Another article about efforts to create the space hotel, the first space hotel, and no, it's not one by Bob Bigelow here in Las Vegas. An interview with astronaut Buzz Aldrin, in which Buzz does sort of his best to confuse the issues of what he really saw out there. You know, he's given these conflicting accounts about this thing that's supposedly an obelisk, something like out of 2001 that's out there in space, other stories that he's gone back and forth on. And this interview from Fox TV, it looks kind of like an effort at damage control on Mr. Aldrin's part. Check it out for yourself. Also, their thought-provoking story about how Galileo's telescope changed the world. I think you'll enjoy that one. And this week, as you know, the Vatican staged a conference about the significance of contact with ETs. The Vatican seems to be all over this subject. And there are a few other stories there that fit the coast-to-coast mold. Check those out when you get a chance. Time now to take our first break, and when we come back, Bob Lazar will join us to talk about hydrogen fuel systems and whether someone wants to stifle such developments. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. A personal shout-out tonight to my sister, Kathy, up there in Northern California, facing a major surgical operation tomorrow. Hang in there, girl. It's all going to work out. Hope you're up tonight listening to the program. And also a shout-out to the folks of Aviation Nation, this huge aviation show they held here in Las Vegas this weekend at Nellis Air Force Base, just down the street from John Lear's house, by the way, so I'd guess he had front row seats. Hope some of those Aviation Nation folks are tuning in tonight as they head home. Joining me now is the president of United Nuclear. That's a company that sells all sorts of scientific equipment and materials online. The owner is a guy best known for other things, though, specifically Area 51 and UFOs. But for now, we're going to talk hydrogen. Bob Lazar, good to have you back on the program.
Well, how you doing, George?
How the heck are you doing? How's life? How's it going in general?
It's pretty good. It was quite a change moving from New Mexico to Michigan. You know, I was born out on the East Coast, and you know, I've lived in the Southwest the majority of my life. And you know, moving back to Michigan, where there's actually moisture in the air and you know, wide temperature swings, and being reintroduced to mosquitoes, I mean, it's quite a change.
You're just going to love your first Michigan winter coming up here, I'd imagine, aren't you?
Well, I actually was here through part of a winter last year, but you know, numbers like 10 below are kind of scary to me. But you know, it's the dark, dreary winters that they keep talking about here. So we'll see. I'm sure I can take it at least for a while. But we're here for the long haul, so it's.
Well, explain to a lot of the viewers or listeners had sent in emails to me before the show. They wanted to know why you picked Michigan, why not the big city in Michigan if you're going to go up there and develop a hydrogen system. What was the deal on that?
Well, boy, that's got to be the number one question that people ask me. Well, it was really mainly it was a family thing. Joy's son, Chris, and his wife, Emily, had a baby recently, making me a grandfather, so which is a unique experience in itself to me. But, you know, the new little guy, Sullivan, lives out right in mid-Michigan, right outside of Lansing. So, you know, as far as moving the business, that needed to be done anyway. We were bursting at the seams, and we needed to expand to, you know, get away just from our sales of scientific materials and equipment to getting back into doing contract work for the government and military, and then also adding on a third division, you know, the hydrogen fuel system development. So one of the reasons was Michigan, of course, has plenty of unemployed auto workers, some of them extremely talented and some of them, you know, desperately in need of a job. And certainly we thought, you know, once we get this thing up and going and we start needing large amounts of people, we already have a pretty well-trained workforce. So that coupled with, you know, the desire to see the new little guy needing more space and just kind of wanting to get away from the dry Southwest.
We'll get into the hydrogen technology in a moment. But, you know, last time we talked to you, you had a suite set up there in New Mexico. You had like 5 acres of land. It was picturesque and beautiful. You'd built this facility in the back of your house with this 30-foot-long particle accelerator as part of your system. And I remember when you were on the show the last time, you had just had some trouble with government folks who showed up at your house one day with Uzis and were very angry with you for what you were selling over the internet, right?
Well, or so that was what they claimed the problem was.
You think it was related to hydrogen?
You know, who knows? You know, it's it's hard to say. But, you know, still, the thing that they said they came down for essentially was we were selling various combinations of chemicals and supplies that could potentially be used to make exploding fireworks, that sort of thing, or explosives in general. They never did take any of that material. The only material they actually physically took from us was, and still to this day, it remains missing, were the original plans for the hydrogen fuel system, which has, you know, always been a thorn in my side. But, you know, still, it was a long court battle. And, you know, essentially we came out, I wouldn't say we came out ahead, but things didn't go as badly as we first thought.
Well, you didn't go to prison.
Didn't go to prison and didn't get hit with the $30,000 fine, which they had, you know, originally intended on hitting us with.
Let's talk about the hydrogen system. Describe it for the listeners, how it works and what its potential would be.
Well, the hydrogen, you know, certainly running a car on hydrogen is nothing new. It's been done, you know, by several companies, many individuals, and it runs basically like you know, running a car on any flammable gas, propane, natural gas, whatever. The only difference about, excuse me, hydrogen is that hydrogen burns much, much faster. It has an extremely high flame front velocity. It almost detonates as opposed to burning evenly like, you know, propane or natural gas does. Storing hydrogen is really the trick because it's a gas, and being a gas, to store it takes up a lot of volume. And you can store it in one of three ways. You can store it as a gas in compressed tanks, which means compressed gas in, you know, heavy tanks, like you would a welding setup, for instance, which takes a heavy tank, usually thick, high pressure, sometimes extremely high if you want to get any quantity of gas in there. And to me, although there are some tanks now that have been developed that are somewhat bulletproof, but still, you have the possibility of a major auto collision, compressed gas at that pressure, spewing out, igniting, you know, potential safety hazard. The other way is liquefying it, where you get a much higher density, but now you're dealing with cryogenic liquid, extremely cold, and you still have all the problems of a collision. These require even more specialized tanks, Dewar tanks, essentially thermos bottles, if you will, on a large scale. And that, again, in a collision, you have a, now you have a cryogenic liquid pouring all over the place and, you know, potential explosions, whatever. The third and most interesting way is storing it inside a metal hydride. And metal hydrides are, at least ours, is it's a granular material. It's a solid, and it's filled in a tank. And what it does, it absorbs the hydrogen gas like a sponge absorbs water. Once it's absorbed the hydrogen, it becomes chemically locked onto it. In other words, if you have the tank full of the hydride material and it's completely charged with hydrogen, I can take that tank and cut through it with a buzzsaw or shoot it with incendiary bullets, and all it will do is smolder like a cigarette. So it's a very safe way to store hydrogen. The only drawback is, with most hydrides, there is a limited amount of charge and discharge cycles, just like a rechargeable battery, for instance. After a while, you have decreased capacity and, you know, other problems. Also, they're very sensitive to impure hydrogen. Some can't be exposed to the air, and on top of that, they're very expensive material. The hydride that I've developed has an extremely high amount of charge and discharge cycle. In fact, over a period of about 7 years, from virtually daily use, we've only lost 12% capacity in storage, which is phenomenal. Another benefit of storing it in a hydride is that the density of the hydrogen is actually greater than that as if you had a cryogenic setup or a liquid hydrogen. So it's really the ultimate way to store hydrogen. And once you can store hydrogen safely in a car, the rest of it's pretty easy from a technological standpoint.
You had told me before, last time I saw you in New Mexico anyway, that your cars were running then on hydrogen. Are they still running on hydrogen?
Well, they're not right now, and that's not because they can't. It's just because of practical considerations. I'm taking apart the tanks and equipment from there, getting ready to go into production and duplicate everything. But there's one vehicle left, a little Toyota Celica. That's the only vehicle we have that runs on hydrogen right now. But at one time, we had a Corvette, Mitsubishi SUV. What else did we have running on hydrogen?
Basically, you're saying, though, that, I mean, the use of hydrogen as a gas to run cars, that's no big deal. That's been proven. You've proven it. Your cars ran for a couple of years on it. Other people have proven it as well. What you bring to the table is this hydride storage system.
Well, that and also the gas handling system and the way it works. How would I describe that? It's not just the hydride, but also the way the hydrogen is handled and burnt and how this system interfaces with the existing vehicle.
Hey, Bob, we're going to take our first break here with you, and we're going to come back and talk about why this is not on the market, what the impediments are to it. We're talking with Bob Lazar here on Coast to Coast. Stay with us, everyone. Thanks for being with us tonight, everyone. Think you're going to have a good time this evening. If you noticed, that song Tom Petty was from 1989. In fact, all the songs we're going to play tonight, Jason Bowers, our engineer, and I picked up some good ones from that year, sort of to go along with the anniversary theme of tonight's show. I mentioned to Jason before we went on the air that, heck, 1989, I was barely a teenager. You know, I'm kidding, of course. And I mentioned to him he must have been old back then. I imagine him wearing John Travolta-type white disco suits and Angel Flight pants, and asked him to send me some photos. And sure enough, they're too embarrassing to show, ladies and gentlemen. I do have one that I sent to Tim Banal. We might post it later, unless Jason wants to pay me off. Anyway, we're talking with Bob Lazar about his unique hydrogen hydride system and the promise that it holds to revolutionize transportation in this country and in the world. And when we come back, we'll get into the idea of why it is not on the market now. What's the big hang-up? Stay with us here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast. I'm George Knapp. We're chatting with Bob Lazar, president of United Nuclear, about his unique hydrogen fuel system. Bob, is this yours and yours alone, or other people have developed a similar thing?
Well, this particular system is mine that I designed and actually been working on for quite a while. The original concept was actually back in the 70s when I started playing with hydride, but it really didn't start serious development, I'd say, till about 7 years ago or so.
Pretty good for a guy who's not really a scientist, right?
Yeah, I haven't heard that in a while. By the way, these 1 o'clock in the morning shows are really a killer for somebody that goes to sleep at 9 o'clock. I mean, the coffee's beginning to kick in now, so I think I'll be a little more.
Well, we appreciate you staying up, but I'll only make you do this every 3 or 4 years or so.
Okay, that's fine.
Well, describe for me the big picture. Let's say you could get this thing going, you could get it to the market. What does it do? How does it transform our transportation industry?
Well, let me
Ultimate
tell
best
you how the
case.
system works. The system comes with an at-home hydrogen generator. This device is about the size of a dishwasher and sits in your garage. What powers it is, depending on your location, it is powered by either solar panels or a wind turbine, electric wind turbine. And you kind of have your choice, depending, there again, what works best for your location, you know, where you are in the U.S. The system takes the electricity from the solar panels or wind turbine, uses that to break down water and produce hydrogen and oxygen. Nothing new. This hydrogen generator is very efficient and produces hydrogen at a fairly modest rate. What it does is, all day long, the generator remains in the garage or wherever you put it in your house, produces hydrogen, and just stores it. Now, when you come home after a day of driving, you're not going to use the car anymore. Open the garage door, put the car in, connect it to the generator. It takes the hydrogen it's produced all during the day and slowly begins to compress it into the metal hydride. Now, it can't be done fast. You can't fill this particular type of hydride, or really any hydride that I know of, very quickly. And while the hydride is being filled, it produces heat, which has to be removed. And that's part of our unique system. These tanks we call smart tanks have a way of dissipating the heat produced inside and also there is an electronic monitoring system in the tanks that provides data to the computer of hydrogen quantity, pressure, temperatures, all kinds of other parameters. The tanks in a car typically will get you about 325 to 400 miles on a fill. Now, 90%, probably more like 95% of the people in the United States don't drive that much in a single day. So typically, if you're only driving, say, 100 miles or less, you always have a surplus of hydrogen. So you're basically just topping off the tanks every day. The tanks don't have to come out of the car to refill it. You just connect a hose to it. There's a little fitting on the back where your gas cap would normally be. And the car at any time can still run on gasoline. In other words, if you wanted to take a cross-country trip, you can start off on hydrogen. When the hydrogen runs out, the car will fairly seamlessly switch back to gasoline and continue on. So it really takes care of the driving, your normal day-to-day going to work, 95% of the driving. It would be great in a delivery truck situation, and we have a couple companies that are really interested in, trying the system out on a large commercial scale. But basically, that's how the system works. There's a couple problems that have to be ironed out. They're more legal concerns, not technological problems. For instance, hydrogen is an odorless, colorless, flammable gas. And if there is a leak, it's a difficult thing to detect. Where if you had a natural gas or propane leak, because of the odors that are put into them, that's pretty obvious. But with hydrogen, you can't put an odorant in it, or the hydride just won't let you do that. It won't store it. It'll poison it and become non-functional. So we have to rely on electronic detectors for any potential leaks. However, there's never more than about a liter of hydrogen in the system at any given time. So, there's a couple little problems that we have to make it, essentially street legal. But as far as the actual operation of the system, its efficiency, its reliability, that's all been ironed out quite a while ago.
But this is a game changer. You're not talking about, as the oil companies and auto companies are talking about, we're going to have a hydrogen system where you drive your car to the hydrogen gas station. You're talking about people making their own at home where they don't need the gas station anymore. And I would think that the principal obstacle to you getting this on is more political and economic. I can't imagine that the oil companies are real crazy about this idea.
No, I can't imagine they're crazy about it either. And of the larger companies I see interested in producing hydrogen vehicle prototypes, again, they're doing exactly what you said. They're trying to switch from a gasoline economy to a hydrogen economy. Well, to me, you're missing the whole point of hydrogen. The reason hydrogen is so great, aside from the environmental factors that the only exhaust in burning it is water vapor, steam essentially, and maybe, a drop of oxides of nitrogen, but that's really negligible. But it's essentially completely clean burning and actually adds moisture to the atmosphere. The great thing about hydrogen is it's so easy to make. All you do is pass electric current through water. There's other ways to produce it and of varying levels of efficiency, but if it's that easy to make, it's ridiculous to buy it. And with our system, essentially you buy the entire kit, the home generator, the conversion kit for the car, and that's the last time you ever buy fuel. And if you sell your car, the kit's completely removable. You pop it out of your car, pop it into the new vehicle. So I believe it's a great system. I'm obviously a big fan of it. I have quite a big list of people waiting for the kits to become available. And it's now it's just a matter of production.
I would think that the oil companies would send hitmen to take care of this, or worse, they would send teams of lawyers to tie it up forever, because it basically puts them out of business. I mean, the potential for economic disruption, I guess, from their perspective, it would be tremendous.
Well, you know, you hear all kinds of stories like that, and I always poo-poo the government conspiracy guys, and you know, and until little things start happening. I had somebody from a government agency, and the reason I don't want to say who it is I don't want to start a fight right now.
Because, you don't want to antagonize them so they come knocking on the door again.
Yeah, well, they already did. And their comment was verbatim, you know, we were speaking about the hydrogen car and looking at it. And his exact words, which really shocked me, was, "Now, you really don't think you're going to be allowed to get this on the road, do you?" Now, it really took me back because I thought we were past that. And, you know, why would a government agency have anything to, well, boy, I could just ramble on here. I'm not going to.
Well, you don't want to get yourself.
I don't want to antagonize them,
right.
But boy, you know, you guys have to see this benefits you too. It really does, but I don't know where it's going to go from here. I'm going to do everything I physically can. It's taken longer than expected. We're expanding our business, and I'm trying to incorporate all three of our businesses into one building. And really, the only reason it's taken so long, I really thought these would be rolling off the production line already, was it's basically my fault. I generally insist on doing everything myself and are a little bit of a control monster when it comes to things like this. And we've had a lot of people interested in investing in it and, you know, helping us out financially in different ways. And, you know, there are so many hydrogen scams out there now and so many ridiculous claims you see all over the internet that, you know, I wanted to be completely self-financed this, which I knew was going to take longer. And that's what our scientific sales division has basically funded this from the beginning. And once we start producing some of the generators initially and then some of the kits, profits from those will increase production and things of this sort. Well, we've had a lot of complaints from potential customers already that things are going too slow. You know, if we would have taken investors on, we could have gotten this going sooner. And, you know, they probably are right. In fact, obviously they're right. But it's just really me being hard-headed and wanting to do this without any assistance is really what the delay is.
Well, I mean, and that knock on the door, though, and not to belabor the point or try to get you in trouble, but it seemed that knock on the door is a problem you're going to have to face again. I mean, the implication
is
that...
It. Yeah,
the implication
really
is
this. If I have to spend, you know, all our finances fighting this in court, we're not going anywhere. And this is exactly what happened last time. It brought us to a dead stop because you can tie things up in court forever. And I just don't want this to happen. So I'm just trying to move ahead as fast as possible and get the systems out. And if we, you know, run into legal problems, we'll just deal with them one at a time. But, you know, boy, is anybody actively trying to stop this? I'm beginning to think that's what I should expect.
Well, the implication that these government guys came and said to the effect, "Do you really think you're going to get this on?" is that they are there at the behest of somebody else. I mean, big oil or big industry or big auto or something like that. And the suggestion that, or the even the implication that government agents would be there working for them against the public will. I mean, that's and against the public interest. That's pretty scary. And I don't know if you want to go into that or not.
Well,
I guess not.
Yeah. Like I said, right now, nothing has happened. And we're just getting ready to move into a new location to start the production of these. So, yeah, I don't want to antagonize them. Certainly, I'll start screaming, you know, if they go on the attack. But right now, maybe it was just a guy saying something off the cuff, you know, coming up with his own personal comment, and maybe it was a warning of, you know, horrific legal battles yet to come. But there is no reason that this system should not be made available, or I shouldn't be allowed to sell this. It's safer than gasoline. It, you know, certainly friendly to the environment, and it's something, once you feel that freedom, that it's like being off the power grid. You know, once you make your own fuel and you're essentially doing it at close to zero cost, it's a completely green system. It's a great feeling of freedom. And, you know, I think it's going to be an extremely popular system.
Tell me this. I think you told me the last time we talked that the government of Michigan, the state there, had indicated that it would support this in some way. Have they been helpful?
They have. The state has been just more than helpful. And even the town that we're in, when we first moved here, they did everything they could to make everything go smoothly. They even got the local colleges to interview and hire people for us. We were invited to lunch with the governor, and have had several meetings down at City Hall. I spoke with the mayor recently, who's doing everything in his power. He's behind us 100%, trying to get us into this new, larger building so we can, you know, jump on this as quickly as possible. So, talk about assistance. They are the most helpful local government I've ever come across. And this is certainly in contrast to New Mexico, which seemed to do everything in their power to thwart anything we were doing.
Well, I would think that if, you know, given the power of the auto industry in Michigan and the political power, that if the state and the local governments are helping you, that maybe the auto industry itself is not necessarily opposed to the idea. I mean, I guess it doesn't matter to them what fuel works as long as it keeps them in business.
Maybe so. And, you know, hopefully that's true.
Anything else you want to say to the listeners on this topic about how they could help you in this regard, help you get it on?
I don't know how they could help at this point.
But, I mean, public support has to count for something on this.
Yeah, it does. You know, I mean, there's no place to, you know, do a letter-writing campaign or anything like that. It really just remains to be seen how things are going to go. If we're just going to be allowed to operate like any other business, or, you know, we're going to be hit with a sledgehammer every time we try and move forward. It's going to happen soon, so we'll see exactly how things progress. But right now, it's just a matter of financially being able to get into a new, larger location and get things moving on, you know, on the limited budget. But I know like I said, it's something we should have already been in production and had things moving. But I'm pretty sure that somewhere in January and February, we'll start firing up some of the new prototypes and hopefully have at least the generators going into production in, you know, the very near future. And that will be followed very shortly by the car kits. And certainly in the future, there's also, as your hydrogen generator produces surplus hydrogen, home generators for backup electrical power, and you can run everything from your gas stove to heating and cooling units on it. So there's a lot of potential down the road aside from automotive applications. So I'm pretty excited about it.
And well, awesome. If you run into some trouble, you have an open invitation to come back to the program and scream to high heaven if you want, and we'll see if that helps. I want to ask one other question before we go to the break and shift gears. The last time we talked, you had a really interesting episode because of something you were selling over We don't have time for that. I want to get into the polonium thing, and then we'll bring on John Lear and Gene Huff. Stay with us, everyone. We shift gears into the subject of Area 51 after this break here on Coast to Coast AM.